From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. And here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage. The arts business is a tough business as is. But what are the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic on South Dakota's creative sector? Jim Spears, Executive Director of Arts South Dakota, joined us for a look at how the need to limit public gathering has been hard-hitting for artists and arts organizations.
Jim, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
For those people who haven't thought about this particular, you know, population group in our state, let's start with laying out kind of why this is such a difficult time for artists.
Well, I mean, I can talk about this in a from a couple of angles, and maybe first I'll just mention it or talk about this personally. I'm a musician. I think a lot of people know I play trumpet in many groups around the state. And, you know, in a matter of about a week, every engagement on my calendar going forward, basically till, you know, the foreseeable future, at least through April and May, has been canceled. So, you know, I look at my calendar. I was supposed to be in Pierre. I was supposed to go to play in Omaha. I had four or five different bookings in Sioux Falls and four different school shows that I was supposed to play just between now and basically end of April. And all of those are canceled. So, I mean, I'm very fortunate. I also have a day job, as I like to say. And so I have other means of income, but a lot of artists don't. And this is just, you know, I'm just kind of a case study of one there, but you can expect my story to be told by pretty much every artist across the state. We're hearing that from everyone.
We had a conversation yesterday with a musician from Minnesota who had to cancel a tour, but this was a CD release tour. So for people who happen to have a book coming out, a CD launch, a new exhibit gallery, opening coming up, how can it be especially impactful for them as they put new work into the world?
Well, I think maybe the first way to look at it is just how emotionally draining that can be. I mean, as an artist, I think most artists would tell you that when you release something, when you share something of your creativity, especially for the first time, you're putting yourself out there. It's a really stressful time. It's an exciting time. And so all of that work that's been done and all of a sudden it just kind of comes to a screeching halt. I think it's emotionally very it's emotionally very challenging. The thing about it that, you know, within the music community specifically, talking to a lot of my colleagues in the music community, that, you know, we realize that this is a pause. I mean, as hard as it is to get through this right now, as disappointed as we all are, you know, staying home and not being out performing. We know it's a pause. And I think for any of those folks that have new creative work that they, were ready to share, ready to unveil to the public, you know, that there's still ways to do that, electronically, of course, with CD releases and websites and so on. But also it's important to remember it's just a pause. And I'm very confident, Lori, that, you know, when we get through this, we don't know how long it's going to take, but, you know, hopefully by sometime in the summer, things will light up again and people are going to want to hear from artists. We're going to be able to help tell this story, help our communities get past this, to come together, to mourn, to celebrate all the things that the arts do every day in the course of life. I think will only be amplified when we can kind of get back out in public, if you will. So it will still happen. It's just right now to have this such a sudden screeching halt to all of our work is really, I mean, it's of course financially impactful, and it's personally impactful in terms of relationships. But I think especially for artists, it's very emotionally hard hitting because we, you know, that's part of the work, is putting yourself out there, and now all of a sudden you're not able to do that, and it's hard to cope with.
I want to be careful about making this analogy, but very specifically, I remember after September 11th, this feels like a similar disruption in the sense that, you know, you couldn't fly, or there was things that you couldn't do that the day before you'd been able to do, and there was a lot of uncertainty. And I acknowledge to listeners who might not like that analogy that they are different. But one of the things I do remember about that time was the concert that was, and we all tuned into this concert of musicians who gathered together to play for us, and it was incredibly powerful and healing. What are you seeing today from South Dakota musicians nationally, people like Yo-Yo Ma and others, who are immediately in this digital space responding by trying to speak to the moment that we're in artistically?
It's a great question. I've seen some national performances, virtual performances happening. I've heard about conversations happening on public broadcasting with, you know, leading music performers or directors of orchestras talking about the power of music right now and being able to tune in to broadcast or get out your favorite record and how that can really lift our spirits. I've heard of, Jeff Coffin's a great saxophonist that was here at Augustana University a couple of years ago for their jazz festival. He's based out of Tennessee, out of Nashville. And he's been getting together with some of his colleagues to do weekly jam sessions online, you know, to do webcasts. Locally, I haven't heard about as much yet, but I do know, I can't say anything specific right now because I don't have all the details, but I do know there's some groups that are planning, working on some virtual concerts that we hope to be able to announce in the coming days. I think it's just taken everyone by such surprise. It's taken, you know, I mean, what feels like it's been forever now, right? You know, and like we've been dealing with this forever. It's only been a couple of days, or a few days. So for some groups, it's just a matter of, you know, it takes time to organize.
Right.
So I think we'll see more and more locally happening. The other thing I could, you know, add to this is there's still the means to support artists, and specifically probably in terms of processes, there's probably more opportunities to support local arts organizations right now. You know, fundraising doesn't stop. You can still go to your favorite community arts organization and donate online to most of them. You can still send a check in the mail. If you have the means to make that second gift this year, a lot of us have already given our annual gifts to local organizations. Some of us might say, you know, I want to do a second gift. Or if you don't have to request a refund for that concert that's been canceled, maybe you can tell the organization, hey, keep that ticket money and help pay your bills getting through this time. Or consider just sending a gift for a virtual concert that may happen, you know. And so there's ways we can help each other get through this. But it's a very different world right now, especially when it comes to the arts and specifically performing arts, which are, you know, that's always been about gathering and about people coming together and communicating. And all that has to be done very differently for the next several weeks. We're going to continue. Arts South Dakota is going to continue to be a resource. Going to our website, checking out our calendars. You know, right now what you see on our calendar is a lot of cancellations,
right.
And that's hard to see. But I think what we'll hopefully be able to exchange those cancellations for events that are happening online, some of these virtual concerts or virtual readings or publishing or anything like that. So I would suspect and I am confident we'll see some of those opportunities announced soon. And then, just like I said, when this is over, be the first in line to get your ticket. Get out there as soon as it's safe. And people, you know, we need to follow our officials and our health guidelines right now. But as soon as someone says it's all clear, you'd be the first one out there to buy that ticket to a concert. You'd be the first one out there to go to the local jazz club. You know, that's what it's going to take. And I think this will all come back online, so to speak, come back to life very quickly.
I want to get to this idea of a national survey to track the impact on the creative sectors. Don't let me forget to include that here. But first, you mentioned just creative ways that people are doing things. And I got a Facebook invite from the Goodnight Theater Collective that's going to have a virtual cabaret. And I think it's a ticketed event. So we're going to invite Bob Wedlin to come and talk about that. But you're already seeing, and I think one of the things to remember is you know, there was also a Facebook post about for the Del Rapids librarians who were just sort of collapsed on the floor after cleaning, that a lot of people, you know, was, you know, tongue in cheek, you know, this is what we're doing today, we miss you. But in a lot of these organizations, they're at work, but they're sanitizing their spaces, they're cleaning, and their heads are, you know, to the ground, and they're trying to figure out what is the first thing that needs to be done. And as they have a little time to process, you know, what can we do next? How can we provide programming? We're going to see some really exciting stuff. And already, you know, that virtual cabaret, just, you know, I was interested in that. I want to see what you guys do. I want to see what you do with this.
Yeah.
Some of my musician friends online are just playing. They're just turning on their cameras and they're playing. Every time that happens, I sit and just relax and breathe, because Jim, we are realizing, you know, how much we relied. I'm realizing how much I relied on the arts in my every. You know, there it's like oxygen for me. So that in the, you know, when you're moving at this fast pace, you forget it, and then all of a sudden, someone, you know, sits at their piano and plays something for me. I'm like, oh, that's right. That is who I am too. That is so important to me. Thank you. So we're really going to see a lot of creativity coming in the days ahead, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, Laura. I think the arts community will be, you know, the leading edge on how we get through this as a people, and how to use creativity to make it through these times. But you're right. I think, the arts are, you know, that's when you think about life, that's living. It's the arts, you know, that's how we as a people really do come together to express our ideas and our feelings and share space with each other. I think that's the power in the job of the creative sector more than anything else. And so right now, as we're all being separated, and we don't have access to that time. Even like you said, we sometimes take it for granted. You know, yeah. we don't realize that, you know, that Thursday night jazz night downtown here in Sioux Falls at the R Wine Bar is just part of our everyday schedule. Now all of a sudden it's like, what? It's gone. You know.
Right.
But that's just temporary, you know. And so I do think that what you've said is that just the arts community is going to be the first group to come up with creative ways to continue that dialogue, to continue expression of ideas, and continue living, right? Continue this life. The arts community will be the folks that really are the leading edge of that. And I would encourage, if you are having virtual concerts, virtual you know, the theater collective or virtual readings, or you're releasing a CD online as opposed to a released concert, let us know at Arts South Dakota, because we'd love to post that information. You know, so many of our events are based on physical gatherings on our statewide arts calendar. So now let's shift those. Let's change that for the time being, and let's really focus on how we can or what we can announce that will be happening online.
Yeah.
These virtual concerts, I think, would be a really fun way to sort of reimagine the statewide arts calendar for the time being.
the president spoke today, you know, we've heard from the president and the vice president a call to construction companies to help with industrial masks. We've heard about research scientists here in South Dakota developing therapeutics. So much research has been done, Jim, on art therapy and music therapy. It's in our hospitals. It's in our clinics. I used to work as an artist in residence and did some work in the cancer center at Sanford for a couple weeks. We know, the role of art in healing, and in such anxious times when even if you're not sick, you might be anxious, you might be feeling the stress of this. Do artists have a responsibility, Jim, to look at the skills that they have and say, what can I do, and realize that those artistic talents and skills are every bit as valuable right now as, being in a lab trying to find treatment?
Oh, yes. I mean, I can't agree with that statement more than I can't add to that more than what you just said. We do have a responsibility, and I'm feeling anxious. I mean, I'll be honest. It's just everything's been turned upside down so quickly. And everything's different, and that just is going to cause stress. And I think you're very right in saying that the arts community, creatives, artists in our communities need to find ways that they can show that the value and the power of healing through the arts. This isn't a time for any of us to just think, well, I can't help. There's nothing I can do. We all have something we can bring to the table. Including the arts community. And so if you're a performer who's, usually playing in the trumpet section of the local symphony orchestra, there's something else you can do. There's some other way you can use your skill set to, the cool thing about trumpet is it's loud. You could go outside and just play. You can be a long way from people and still make music.
Trumpet is an excellent social distancing instrument, isn't it?
It is. So see, right there, as soon as the weather's nice enough, get outside and play some trumpets, play some fanfares or something for the neighborhood. Just don't do it too early or too late.
Right.
But the, that kind of thing, I've seen a couple friends that have done virtual quartets, like brass quartets online, where they've played each instrument and just dubbed or recorded over themselves and then posted that. So they've created a piece of music that normally would need to be played by four people, but because of technology, they can go and record each part and layer them together, and this is on video, and then post it. And that's fun, and it's something we can do. And if you get five people that watch it, great. You've done something good for those five people. If you get 500, great. It's not about the reach or the impact numbers. It's just about being active and sharing your voice and sharing your talents and staying positive, frankly. I think that's the other thing that the arts can do is tell us that, there's something better to look forward to here, and we're creating art for the future. We're creating art for the what's coming. There's life to be lived.
Yeah, tell me about this national survey that is seeking input on the impact of this on creatives right now.
Yes, so Americans for the Arts is our sort of national advocacy organization. It's sort of the big brother to Art South Dakota and what we do for the state. And they started a national impact survey, just maybe 4 or 5 days ago. And so what we're asking all South Dakota creative industry, whether it's an organization or an artist, the survey is very wide ranging. It's anybody that's involved in the creative industry. We're asking that you go and go to our website, artssouthdakota.org. And then there's a page on that website that says right at the top, it's COVID-19 resources. And what we're doing is we're compiling any type of arts specific resource that is helpful to get through this time. Well, you'll see things from the National Musician Federation in there. You'll see things from the South Dakota Community Foundation. You'll see things from the Bush Foundation, from the National Endowment for the Arts. So any resource that we are learning about that is beneficial to artists or arts organizations, we're trying to track on this resource page. So it's a really valuable tool for the creative community. The top, right in the middle, top billing of that page is the Americans for the Arts Impact Survey. And it's a very simple survey, takes 5 minutes. And what it's doing is it's measuring the impact to the creative industry of basically the lost work, the lost events, the lost income. And right now, Americans for the Arts just today said 91% of the responding arts organizations have indicated that they have canceled one or more events. So, I mean, whenever you see a number of 90%, you know this is a pretty pretty impactful time, right? I mean, everyone's right. reporting a loss is being affected. Here in South Dakota, we just started pushing the survey the last couple of days. So it's a bit fresh around here, but just in the last couple of days, we now have 77 organizations that have responded. And we know there are hundreds more that we hope will get online and answer these questions. And we're showing a total reported financial impact, negative impact to our creative sector right now of about $60,000. So, you know, if you look at 77 organizations and almost $60,000, I mean, that's, you know, you can see that the financial impact per organization is pretty heavy. And that's only going to increase as more people take the survey. And I think what's important about it is A, it will help us measure locally just how deep this goes, but also gives us nationally a picture of how the creative sector is sort of reeling from this. That the creative industries is one of the largest parts of our national economy. It's 4.9% of our GDP, I believe, something like that, 4.92. And it's a larger industry nationally than construction, than agriculture. You know, now this is nationally, not just in South Dakota, but it does show you the weight that the creative industry has on our economy. And so we want to remind our leaders nationally and locally, of course, that we need to consider the creative sector when we're talking about economic relief. It's very important that we find ways to get our artists and our arts organizations through this time. You know, the artists especially, I think, you know, there's just so many of our artists are independent, you know, businesses of one, you know, so they don't have really that support network that you get from working within an organization oftentimes. You also find that artists are usually some of the first that don't have the health care benefits or, you know, have to pay a lot for their health care benefits. And then you also find that the old adage that, you know, your first major gig as an actor is being a waiter, you know, your first big breakthrough is your first job as a waiter. Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting adage because, you know, someone in that position is hurt double, you know, their creative work, their acting, their night job, if you will, is disrupted. Those performances aren't happening. That income is not coming in. But then also their, so to speak, day job is as a service worker at a restaurant has stopped, you know, for many of them. So, you know, a lot of the artists in our communities work in both the creative sector and the service sector, and, right. and both of them are being impacted so greatly. So we do encourage, like you said, please go take the survey. It will help us tell our story and find solutions to sort of prop up that part of our economy, and also that page that I mentioned on our website, I think will be beneficial, especially as more and more relief efforts come online locally. We're hearing from the South Dakota Community Foundation. We're hearing from the Sioux Falls Area Community Foundation. the Bush Foundation, Springboard for the Arts. There's all these groups, specifically in South Dakota, but even just in the Midwest, that are now coming up very quickly, designing programs that will provide immediate relief to the creative sector.
Now, of course, here at SDPB Radio, we're going to continue celebrating artists from across the state. Mark Joseph is a Twin Cities-based blues guitarist and vocalist who is scheduled to tour the Black Hills as part of his CD release tour. Now, many artists have had tours and events canceled, and the economic disruption is devastating for the arts community, as you previously heard. In the Moment intends to keep those art conversations going, including music like that of Mark Joseph.
Mark Joseph joins us now on the phone. Hey, Mark, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Florrie, thanks for having me.
All right, tell us a little bit about the disruption for coronavirus and canceled events and the impact that has on artists, especially at a time when you were releasing a new CD and going on tour.
Yeah, well, we've never seen anything quite like it. Obviously, it's forced us to have to reschedule many dates and tours. Now it's getting into, you know, it's hard to say at this point how far out it's gonna go. My Black Hills dates that were supposed to be this week are currently rescheduled to May 5 through 9 in the spring here. But you know, again, like, it's hard to say where this is gonna kind of where things are sort of gonna go back to normal of any kind of normalcy, I guess.
But yeah,
it's been a major impact on us.
Well, we need our artists just like you need, you know, an audience. So we've got music queued up from the CD. We're going to tell us a little bit about the CD itself at first before we get to Bound to Be Blessed.
So my new record, it came out in September of 2019, and we've been touring behind it, promoting it ever since. It's a blues record. And, it was a real pleasure to make. It was co-written and produced by a gentleman by the name of Steve McCormick. About half of it was recorded in Minnesota. The other half was recorded in Los Angeles. And, it's got some really amazing special guests on it. Stanley Behrens from the band War, Richie Hayward from Little Feet is on it. John Avila from Oingo Boingo is on it. Award-winning producer as well. It's kind of a return to my roots, as a musician in general. I play guitar because of the blues, and I've spent my career playing various different styles of music and as the blues as well, but I'm sort of coming back to my roots to sort of, it's a regeneration and just, you know, kind of the roots of why I play music in the first place. So it's an exciting record, and we had a lot of real blast making it.
All right, let's take a listen.
Don't you cry no more.
I'm seeing a lot of people, with intentional efforts to reach out to artists and purchase their music or their merchandise or support them online because they know how important the arts are. You know, as people stay home, everybody's situation is different, but some people do have a little extra time, and they're definitely turning to the arts in film and music and dance and other things. I'm looking at your website, and you have a quotation here that says, "The blues is my home, a place filled with emotions, the past, an uncertain future, dark, light, it's all there." And boy, I guess we really need the blues now, because that kind of feels like the cultural moment that we're in as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the blues are a story of trial and tribulations, you know. So it is, the blues is always there, even in good times, too. I mean, it's always the human condition, you know.
Are you able to create right now? I know I've had a hard time, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to just get away, you know, with my job. It's just, you know, immersion. And I go home and I think I'm going to doodle or draw. I'm going to do some writing because that's my art. I can't concentrate. Can you create right now?
Mm-hmm. We'll see. I'm just starting to get into it. I was in the studio last night, I was digging into some old files. We're listening to some multi-track live shows that we have been sitting on for a while. And, you know, I haven't exactly written anything new just yet, although I think that's going to happen here soon. And I just kind of reconnected with my studio and engineer, who are luckily are 5 minutes from my house. So that's real convenient. And yeah, we're going to definitely get in there and start writing and getting creative. I've got some concepts for my new album that we're sort of starting to explore. And in fact, my producer, Steve McCormick, who did this last record for me, he'll be producing my next record too. We're already thinking out, you know, for the next project. And it's sort of going to be a series of duets and sort of special guests. So I'm going to try to do collaborations with like all these different artists, some of my heroes and old friends and things like that. And so in fact, he called me yesterday and said he's already got a concept ready for me to go with Peter Rowan out in California. So we'll probably be like co-writing over the phone and via video chats and things like that, you know?
All right. That gives me hope, for the future and the things are going on. Mark Joseph, I'm going to say thank you to you and close out the show and then leave people with another song, if that's all right. So give people the website again where they can connect with your music further and tell them the name of the CD, please.
Yep. You can check out my website is markjoseph-music.com. You can find me on Facebook at Mark Joseph Music. And the new record's called The Musician and the Muse, and I encourage you all to go pick it up. It's available on all platforms, and everybody just keep the faith and stay positive. We're all going to get through this together.
I went to see the Night Tripper way down in New Orleans. I'm running from my heart was busting at the seams.
Now, of course, artists aren't the only ones struggling. Many South Dakota companies have a number of decisions to deal with. Some South Dakota companies specifically have struggled with the decision to allow employees to work from home. Well, others were ready for action before coronavirus had a major impact on their community. John T. Meyer is the owner and CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. He joined Lori Walsh to talk about helping your employees make the transition, best practices for working from home, and leadership during times of crisis.
John T., welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Happy to be here. Good to see you.
So Lemonly made the decision to go remote entirely fairly early in this game. That's something that you were prepared to do, partially because of the kind of business that you are, but partially because you wanted to take a stand early. Tell us a little bit about that decision-making process.
Yeah, you bet. So we do a weekly Wednesday leadership meeting every Wednesday. That's redundant. And last week we sat there and said, look, we started to take survey of the landscape, and you know, South Dakota, we still were looking okay, but we decided, you know, let's be bold and let's make the move early and show people that we can all figure this out, other businesses. Now granted, as you said earlier, We're fortunate. We do most of our work online. We do have meetings with clients, but those can move to video calls, phone calls. So we understand that's a privilege, and so we recognize that first, but we wanted to say, look, for those of you who probably can do it but haven't tried, consider it. And so we decided to, we also think our policy last week was to everyone, if you're not feeling well, certainly work from home. And I think that just puts a lot more stress and decision making on the team. And so we finally said, let's set a deadline. We set Monday yesterday. And that gave everybody a couple days to clean up their desk, take any hardware that they needed to take home, and just kind of mentally prepare. And so as of yesterday, everyone was on a video call, and we did our, we're trying to do business as usual.
Yeah, we had it was not our first Skype meeting, but it was a Skype meeting with a large number of people today. And I remember thinking as we did this, we really are going to keep this kind of thing in the future. So talk a little bit about, as people navigate and learn how to work remotely, we're also taking time to realize that some of these things are things that could be innovations that we implement for best practices in an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I already saw the cartoon, right, that a guy standing in his computer and he said, oh my gosh, I realized that all those meetings could have actually been emailed. and so I think some people have said this is going to be sort of remote work is going to have its moment right now, some out of necessity.
Yeah.
It's going to go great for some companies, and they're going to realize this is something we can do. It's not a scary thing. I actually trust my employees. And it's going to be really hard for others. Some companies just weren't prepared or ready. And so I feel, I feel for those organizations, and it's going to be, the remote experience might be very challenging. I think what I usually say in our world has changed in about a week or two, what I normally tell the companies is just try it. I always say use the E word, which is an experiment. And so whether you say, let's just try one day a week, or let's try the first Thursday of every month, and let employees try it on for size and feel it out, and then what I say to employees then is, go home and, work your butt off, right? Like, be very productive, very organized, be effective, and show your team, your boss, your manager that you can do it. Now, I realize all things have changed, right? Schools are closed, kids are at home, and companies are being thrusted into this, whether they like it or not. And I think that's the hard part. So a few best practices. I always suggest you really need to over-communicate, whether you're using phone calls, conference calls, Slack, whatever it is, you need to be over-communicate. And that's really where it keeps the trust going. It keeps the communication lines open. So, hey, I'm jumping offline to, serve. Even I have my four-year-old here. So
perfect.
She's on the call with me right now.
A great example. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Tell your team what you're doing. And if you're busy, what? And I'm going to go to work. Thanks, Margo. Sorry about that.
No, I'm not, because that we've had that before where we'll have a radio conversation and somebody's kids or dogs will come in. And I'm like, no, we're setting the example that they're part of our lives right now. They're part of our community. So hey.
Yeah, this is real, right?
It's real.
I know everyone's going through it. And yeah. Honestly, that's the part that's probably, I know how to work from home. Art Lemonly knows how to work from home, but doubling as an employee and as a school teacher has been challenging.
And for a lot of people, not to break this down to a gender role, but a lot of women really struggle with, allowing themselves to say, yep, I'm taking care of my kids right now, too. So it's a good example for you to set to say, this is what we're doing, and this is the new normal for a while, at least. So be super productive and over-communicate. What are some other best practices, John?
Yeah, I think setting the culture and mindset around remote work, I think we get too obsessed with the tools. So thinking about, should we do Zoom? Should we do Skype? Should we do Slack? Should we do, the tools are there and they work. But if the tools will not be a cure-all, right? You need managers, leaders, CEOs need to embrace the idea of remote work. I always like to say, I'll get the question if I give a talk about this topic, and how do you know your employees are actually working? Well, then I usually say, maybe you shouldn't, if you don't trust them, you probably shouldn't have hired them in the first place, right? And so I think that's one of the first things leaders and managers need to let go is trust your people, trust them. If you think you hired the right people, you hired them for a reason, let them work. But also everyone deserves a little bit of grace right now, right? Things are stressful. There's a lot of uncertainty, and it feels like every decision you're making as a leader right now is has a 24-hour expiration date. It just seems like the facts keep changing.
Yeah.
You know, first it's no events more than 250, and then it's 50, and now it's 10. These are hard to operate. And so I think everyone also should give leaders grace that, you know, a decision is a decision for now and maybe not etched in stone or new policy. You know, hopefully in a few weeks we can all get back to our offices.
Yeah, knowing that going in. And you also said in a Facebook post and a video that you posted that you don't know what the future is for Lemony right now. You don't know what the future is for your employees, for yourself. You've still got a brick and mortar space that you have to pay, you know, a lease on, or I'm assuming that there's still bills to be paid. And even you don't really know the future, but you're stepping into this role as a leader saying, we're figuring out this future together. I thought that was really inspirational. I needed to hear that message at that moment. I don't even work for Lemonly. So
I think what I recommend right now to any business owner, any person, any organization is to really put your customer, your family, put whoever you can first, right? Really give, like, operate from a place of giving. And it's not a sales pitch. It's not a, how can we make money off of this? How can this affect our bottom line? You're exactly right. I don't know what Lemonly looks like in 2 or 6 or 12 months, but I know we're going to get through this, and it'll probably look different in some way, but I think our world is going to look different forever after this. And so right now you have the opportunity to really, you know, give first. And I find that, you know, leadership can be lonely, and sometimes I get my own head when I'm by myself. And so if I can be calling people, checking in on people, giving, checking on my team, our customers, and reaching out and just saying, how can we help you? I have nothing to sell you. I just, what do you need right now? Because not only is that the right thing to do, but you actually could, it's a time where you can probably gain a customer for life. Because when we get through this, and we will, on the other end, you know, we're going to have a new way to work and a new way to do business. And those people will remember that you were there for them. You know, so I love seeing restaurants stepping up and saying, hey, this is scary, this is hard, but we'll do delivery, we'll do pickup. I got a text message from Parker's. That's a place that my wife and I love to go. It said, would you want to order carry out? You know, and this is Parker's, like, fine dining restaurant, Sioux Falls. And so the rules of the game have changed, and you need to be able to change with them.
Right. You also say you can just control the things that you can control. And you quoted Frozen in your video, so I really are Frozen too, which is this wonderful message of all you can do is the next right thing. Tell us a little bit about, you know, making, you know, those leadership decisions, which people in the past maybe have thought stand for longer than 24 hours or even 12 hours or 20 minutes, depending on when the next, federal press conference is, right? Understanding that going in and saying all you can do is the next best thing, the next right choice is the choice to make.
Yep. I'm a big believer in a concept called stoicism, which is the idea that you can only control control your thoughts and feelings, right? So someone cuts you off on the freeway, you can get mad at them, but who knows what's going on in their life and their world, what type of day they're having. So what you can control is your thoughts and reactions and emotions to that moment. And I think that's something we all could practice a little bit right now, because you know, I've read the articles that say 6-8 weeks, like the interview before, months, who knows? And that's, you can get to a dark place when you really start worrying about those things that, frankly, you have no control over. So what can you do right in front of you, right? If it's going for a walk and getting some fresh air to clear your head, if it's sending a text message or making a phone call to a loved one, just checking in and see how they're doing, that's probably the next right thing that you can do. And for now, that's all we can focus on. And if you can do that and just take it one day at a time, you know, we'll get through this.
John T. Meyer is owner and CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls, and I've been tuning into your Facebook video. So more of that, I think, helps people even beyond your own staff with some of those messages. So we appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me, and be well. Take care.
Now it's time for poetry from Studio 47.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Sun Young Shin. She was born on May 12, 1974, in Seoul, South Korea. When she was 13 months old, she was adopted by a white couple in Chicago. After graduating from high school, she attended Boston University for 1 year before transferring to Macalester College in St. Paul, where she majored in English. Shin then studied for an MA in teaching at the University of St. Thomas. Her books include Skirt Full of Black, Rough and Savage, Unbearable Splendor, and a bilingual children's book, Cooper's Lesson. She also co-edited Outsiders Within, Writing on Transracial Adoption, and she edited the very successful and necessary A Good Time for the Truth, Race in Minnesota. Shin has won the Asian American Literary Award, the Minnesota Book Award. She has been a finalist for the Penn USA Literary Award, and she has also won fellowships from the Bush Foundation and the Blacklock Nature Sanctuary. She lives in Minneapolis, where she teaches at the Loft Literary Center, and she is also the co-director of Poetry Asylum. Today's poem is Orphans of Skynet. I suppose I should say straight away that this isn't a poem, nor is it entirely an essay. It's something in between. One of the things I admire about Shin's work is that she breaks down boundaries between genres, ideas, and countries. For me, I don't especially care if something looks like a poem or not. If it's well written, if it makes me think, and if it recalibrates how I view the world, well, that's what good literature should do. In this particular piece, Shin places into conversation the trauma of adoption and what it means to be a cyborg. She references the Terminator movies and talks about a biomachine that is alive but has no past. This is Orphans of Skynet by Sun Young Shin. In the United States, we live in a vast bureaucracy of paper, words, laws, official stamps, and government surveillance, increasingly digitized. Kafka's dark visions and critiques of bourgeoisie relations and the structures we build to sanctify, torture, and imprison each other remain as relevant as ever. I find signing paper documents quaint. I am pleased that one's signature, writing using one's own bones and muscle and flesh to hold a pen and move it in a pattern depositing ink onto a piece of mashed and flattened wood pulp, is still legally binding. Yes, I sign things digitally as well, and I am grateful for the convenience, but anything handmade, including a signature, retains its magic for me, as it does for many of us who want friction in our lives. Those who want to know we are real and the things we interact with have realness, have bodies. But I am, we are, flesh, not paper, and even paper is tree flesh, and I do not know when I was born or where or to whom. I don't know the woman whose body I was created by and grown in, and whose body I emerged from into the air-breathing world. I have two of my own children, born from my body, and that unknown woman's body, but they will almost certainly never meet in this world. This absence, this ambiguous loss, has become part of my children's inheritance and their origin stories, or lack thereof. In Minnesota, there are more than 10,000 Korean adoptees. I am just one more, but I did not come here from Korea. I arrived at O'Hare Airport in Illinois in June 1975 and grew up in a Chicago suburb. I came to Minnesota as an adult through chance. Little did I know of the Korean adoption en masse to this mostly Lutheran place. Now, I am one of many. Spoiler ahead. In Terminator 4 Salvation, Marcus Wright, a death row convict, is resurrected as a cyborg, part organic, part biomechatronic being. In an earlier Terminator movie, the cyborg Skynet was recreated as a hybrid of computer system and self-aware being. The protagonist of Terminator 4 has a name with Latin origins. Marcus means dedicated to Mars, the god of war, an appropriate deity for the American proclivity towards endless war. Marcus's last name, Wright, means maker or builder. Marcus Wright is a protector who has been rebuilt. When he comes to discover, after being captured and chained like a criminal and a slave, that he has been rebuilt as a human-machine hybrid, he is horrified and traumatized. One of the pieces of language that is standard in what I will call adoption land is the term biological, as in, this woman has two adopted children and one biological child. Of course, they mean biologically related or genetically related. Biological has become shorthand for not adopted. But I am biological too. I am alive. When I was growing up, the lingo was their own, as in they have one adopted child and one of their own. By the end of Terminator 4, salvation is indeed found for several parties in the narrative, including Marcus Wright, protector and builder. Wright donates his heart to the leader of the resistance who has been injured in a climactic battle. Without the sacrifice of Wright, he will die. In the adoption land of my youth in the 1970s and 80s, terms such as sacrifice were common parlance in regard to our birth mothers. Our Korean mothers sacrificed, and these Western women became our mothers. Origins and sacrifice dovetailed nicely with my Roman Catholic upbringing. God sacrificed his only son. Jesus sacrificed his life for his sinners. The priest sacrificed his desire to have a family for his flock. Congregants sacrificed their donations to the church for the less fortunate. Mothers sacrificed their dreams for their children. Fathers sacrificed their days for their families. And onward. I'm not a cyborg, because they don't really exist yet. But I feel like one. Not fully human, not fully machine, but not able to function without both systems. I'm biological, but constructed, transformed, a permanent transformation, with much of my coding erased and lost. Unpredictable, like a computer system that has become self-aware. The future is uncertain, and the past, my origins, is in shadow.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening. Wash those hands for 20 seconds at the least.